Jack of all trades, master of none, is a saying we've all grown up with when you're looking into careers. But for the role that we're going to discuss today, it is the exact opposite. We're talking about understanding tournament management from junior to the highest of elite levels. We're talking about being media savvy, so print, television, radio, and then in person having that same personality to carry it all off. And a finger on the pulse of all things golf, from architecture to operations. So I'm going to ask you, can you figure out what role we're talking about today here on The Business of Golf? Stay tuned and we'll see if you're right. Welcome into The Business of Golf. I'm Allison Johnson here with my co-host Adam Grubb. Adam, any ideas on who we're going to be speaking to today, what type of role they have?
I would say somebody around a course, maybe a course superintendent, somebody like that, a golf course superintendent.
Nice guess. We even have a better, more dynamic role where we're talking about everything from food and beverage to member
general manager,
local politics. We got the general manager. That's right. I knew you'd get there. So I want you to welcome in Colin Burns. He's a longtime, very well-respected general manager at Winged Foot. He's been there about 30 years, and he has been there to see so many changes in the industry from a private club perspective, as well as growing the game of the people that are coming in, the tournaments and how they're managed. So we're very excited to have him here today. Colin, thank you so much for joining us.
Allison, thanks for having me. Adam, good to see
good
you.
To
thank
see you.
So one of the things that we've talked about is that in your role, you really need to have a broad and deep understanding of a lot of different topics. But not only that, you really have to be everything to everyone. So how do you manage that on the day-to-day? I would imagine that that's pretty tough to always be on.
Well, you know, it is tough, and it's funny. The first thing I think of is how it translates into my personal life. And my wife is always asked, why don't you talk to the neighbors? Why don't you, you know, that kind of socialization? And I've explained to her over the last 25 years, and she really does get it now, that by the time you go home, so I'm going sort of to the end of the story, then I'll go back to the beginning of the story. By the time you go home, you're really burnt out, and not in a sort of a pejorative kind of, you're just tired. You're tired because you have really genuinely in your heart wanted to be all things to all people. You've wanted to listen to the superintendent talking about a particular issue, whether it's a labor issue or whether it's an agronomic issue. You really have wanted to listen to the head pro vent a little bit, because that's part of what I do. You know, part of it's sort of, father confessor kind of. So I spend a lot of time listening to senior management staff, because it's the place they can vent, because they can't always vent to board members, because that's not always sort of the astute thing to do. So so you go through that. So there's the venting with the senior staff. There's concern with perhaps a neighbor whose backyard has been flooded because of a particular issue. Maybe a tree came down. And so because you take it all, at least in my case, very seriously and very much to heart, that enables you to stay up. It enables you to stay engaged, because you really do care. I really do care about the neighbors, and we're very much good neighbors and very supportive of the community. Very much in love with the membership here, as I have been for all these years. A very genuine connection with the staff. So you listen to the concern about somebody's mother who just came back from the Dominican Republic but doesn't have health insurance, and you try to connect her with a doctor who's a member of the club. And so the same thing that keeps you engaged and up and into what you're doing is the same thing that at the end of the day is pretty much sort of gone. The tank's empty because you haven't been faking it. You know, I guess you could go through a day like mine and fake it. I don't think you could fake it for 30 years, but you could fake it for a little bit. So Allison, to try to answer the question, I think it's a genuine concern. It's a genuine caring for others that keeps you engaged and helps you. By the way, you may not always have all the right answers, particularly when it's a director of golf courses, then it's the head professional, and then it's the executive chef. I mean, you keep layering on all these people who have different issues. but you at least try to be a good listener. And I think that, I know that sounds very trite and cliche, being a good listener, but an engaged, active listener, not interrupting, as I'm doing to the two of you right now. You know, staying in that moment. And so that's my, my sort of meta sort of.
Colin, as you're at Wingfoot, and I don't want that to just kind of gloss over the listeners. I mean, that's a prestigious, amazing club, and it is world renowned, well known, well respected. Some incredible golf moments have happened at Wingfoot, and not just in the pros, but I'm sure in the day to day of the members there, some incredible life changing, dollar changing moments have happened on your course. Do you see yourself in the golf business or in the service business?
Well, I would say the hospitality business, because I think my mission is to provide the membership with a hospitable, warm, welcome environment, sort of gate to gate. There's all the elements to it. There's the golf course conditioning. There's the comportment of the staff. There's the management, the fiduciary responsibilities. But I think of myself in the hospitality business in a very broad sense. Now, there's no getting around the fact that Wingfoot Golf Club, not Country Club, and I still recall to this day, because it still stings a little bit. And as a matter of fact, I just saw, it's so funny, he's 94 years old, Bill Gardella. He interviewed me basically down below where my office is in the dining room. And at that time, I was interviewing. I was having a couple of drinks along with other people from the search committee. And I said, Country Club. And he turned very quickly and said, young man, this is a golf club. This is not a country club. And to this day, by the way, I've corrected many people over the years. I have never personally made that mistake again. So yes, very much in the golf business, but I think, it's not just golf here. Those people who have been to Wingfoot, who have experienced Wingfoot as a guest, maybe at an outing, maybe as a guest of a member, they've come to see us in sort of our best light. We welcome people. We don't shun. We never treat a guest like a guest. We treat guests like members, and we treat members like family. And that all comes from this hospitality background that I come from. So not the golf, not the entertainment, but hospitality industry.
So one of the things that you have been known for in your tenure there is how you've trained your staff. You talk about how your staff is your family, and that really is shown. So I know that one of your most recent graduates from Wingfoot, has gone on to her own general manager role. And she's, Lily's a wonderful human being, and everybody who works under you seems to go on to these great jobs. So for people who are growing up in the club industry and in the club space, just talk a little bit about what you look for in someone who's just starting out.
Allison, that's a really good question. It's something we talk about all the time. When there's an opportunity to hire, now at Wingfoot, we have very little turnover. I mean, Lily was here for 10 years before leaving. We pride ourselves on the fact that we don't have a lot of turnover. Longevity, continuity is something that I built into sort of the board psyche when I first came here. I said, it's much cheaper to pay someone more and to keep them with us than to continually have people turn over. And that came from, it's funny, when I first started out, and I'll get to your, this is how I answer questions, by sort of going in circles a little bit, that discursive kind of, and then we'll get back to it.
You're not on the stand here, Colin, so take all the time you want to get to the answer. Don't worry.
That's funny. So when you're, what you're looking for, I'll try to get to the answer. So I think one of the things you're looking for is not the person who's necessarily the most technically proficient, but somebody who, in our case in particular, if they love the game of golf, whether it's a CFO, whether it's executive chef, and by the way, both the CEO and the executive chef are both golfers. Lily became a golfer. We encourage it. So that's part of who we're looking. When we engage someone here, and again, as I was saying before, we don't have a lot of turnover. Continuity is part of what we pride ourselves on. As a matter of fact, I'm 30 years. I'm probably on the seniority list. I'm still probably number 25 or 30 on the employee seniority list. Wow. So there are people here. I mean, we had somebody retire after 50 years. He worked on the grounds crew.
Wow.
So what are we looking for? We're looking for somebody who gets who we are. It'd be like, you know, somebody going to work for Disney and not knowing what the Disney Corporation is all about, right? You come to Wingfoot Golf Club, if you don't, whether it's director of golf courses, whether it's head professional, Mike Gilmore, I'll never forget interviewing Mike Gilmore, and he said, this is the Yankee Stadium of golf. This is it. Needless to say, Mike goes right to the head of the class, right, during the interviewing process.
Okay,
he
so got compliments
it.
Work. Got it.
Yeah, we're very, just like Adam, you know, complimenting his zippy. I mean, I knew that has endeared me forever now with him. So that means something to us. When you have, it's funny, you know, the chef will be walking somebody around, or Ileana, who has now taken over for Lily, another one of my wonderful superstar, you know, employees who I just adore. I'll engage the person who they're walking with, and just not as part of the interview, just because I want to know something about them. And I'll ask them, what do you know about Wingfoot? Have you been here? Have you golfed here? And if the answer is no, you're sort of like, you know, let's move on. But they could be a young culinarian from the Culinary Institute or somewhere else, and they go, oh my God, you know, I caddied my entire life. I watched the U.S. Open, you know, in 2020. But all of a sudden, they have that connection to us that we want. So it's that connection, and it's that personality. We look for personality. And Allison, Adam, if you haven't been here, or if you've, Allison, I know you've been here recently. We really pride ourselves on welcoming people in a very genuine, way, and that's what we look for, especially when it comes to the clubhouse staff, and not just clubhouse. Well, clubhouse including, you know, golf operations, golf shop, and it's something that we, you know, we really do pride ourselves on. So we're looking for people who are genuinely in their hearts. You know, it's funny. Somebody in an interview not too long ago, they asked me, so where does hospitality come from? And I said, you know, it's very simple. I use my daughter as an example. Lovely, wonderful. I hope she doesn't listen to this.
I hope she does.
But you know, she sort of gets, she worked here her whole life, gets it immediately, gets the importance of the contact, the eye contact. So we're very much impressed when somebody exhibits that right from the beginning. You can teach technical skills. You can teach somebody how to fold shirts or do inventory or do those things. You can't teach them to feel that thing. So anyway, the question was, where does hospitality come from? It comes from the heart. If you don't have it in your heart, like Lily and Ileana, my daughter, and people who I work with, if it's not in their heart, then it's just it it's not the same.
There's a the adage that golf is stuffy, that country club, golf club, whatever the case may be, prestigious places like and grounds like where you work and are the GM, they have a certain gravitas towards them and a certain kind of, you know, country club feeling. You guys have spent a lot of time trying to make sure that your place doesn't feel that way. People feel welcomed. Yeah. They feel exclusive, but yet inclusive. It's a very tight rope that you have to go through to make people feel that way. How do you do that?
Well, you know, one of the ways we do that is by constantly reminding ourselves that no matter who's on the property, whether it's a contractor, a vendor, an employee, a guest, a member, all of you, all of those people I just mentioned, are in some way representative of Wingfoot. They are promoters of our brand. I'll give you an example that happened recently. It's funny, and Ann Drake, who I work with right next door, Ann, she's priceless. We did a blood drive in the dining room. Well, she was aghast that we would have stretchers and IVs. She came downstairs. I could see in her face. She was just beside herself. You know, this gorgeous custom-made carpet and the curtains, and there are people laying there with needles in their arms. And so at the end of this, the people were leaving, and I said to one of the employees, who will remain nameless, did you offer them lunch? The people, the volunteers from Red Cross. And they said, no. I pulled them off to the side, He's new. And I gave him one of my stern looks, sat down, and I said, I don't care who it is, especially somebody who's volunteering their time, doing something that's a social good, we offer them something to eat and something to drink. That's who we are. Now, why? Why is that important? It's important to me personally because of the effort they're making, but it's also very important for me that these people from the American Red Cross left Wingfoot and said to their friends, relatives, whoever it was, what a nice group of people. They're just, this is, and that's, Adam, to your point, is we really don't distinguish. When you're here at the club, you're here at the club. Whether, I mean, we had a meeting this morning. First thing I said, and there's, I joined the meeting late, did anyone offer you a cup of coffee or something to eat? The answer was no. I looked at the three other employees like, seriously. It's the first thing. Now, my Italian mother, you know, helped ingrain that in me. But that's who we are. I mean, it's, you know, what's funny, I always use the example, there'll be, you can be at a comparable prestigious club, and if you're walking around unattended, you know, you're getting the stink eye, you're getting the, you know, basically, what are you doing here? What I've always instructed the staff to do, first thing you do is, hi, how are you? Good to see you. Who are you with today? Oh, you're Adam's guest. Why don't you come on in? Don't stand in the hallway. Come on in. Change your shoes. Would you like something to eat? Would you like something to drink? We don't stand on that formality. And Adam, I think you've picked up on that, and Allison, I know you have. We don't want anyone to feel uncomfortable. Look, I've gone to enough famous golf clubs, country clubs, where you are uncomfortable, there's some, where you're not sure where to walk, where to stand, which staircase to use, because that's the member staircase, and that's not – this is a wonderfully welcoming – you know what I'm talking about. You probably know that. I actually went down that wrong staircase at that club out in Long Island, and I walked down the member staircase. It was as if I'd committed a crime. I go,
member staircase? Okay. I mean, come on. What are we talking about?
I'll tell you later. Anyway, we are not that. And I'm glad that you've picked up on that in being here, because it's something we really do.
Well, Allison, there's even some local clubs that aren't prestigious and aren't even on the map as far as you know, being famous, that are in our local areas, wherever you live in the country, that are that way. Like, hey, those five spots are for members only. Okay. I'll go to the
sixth. Now you can just say, listen, you're no Winged Foot.
Yeah,
that's right. Down. Well, the thing that I think comes across so much, Colin, with what you're saying is really it's about authenticity, right? And none of us are better than anyone else, and no one else is better than us, right? There's this real true inclusion and equality and general appreciation for the sport. And I think that traditionally, you know, the clubs that have done a lot of big events really have this. Not that other clubs don't have it too, so everybody relax. But, you know, clubs that have hosted big professional tournaments and have a history of doing so, there's a different sense of appreciation for the game as a game, right? Not just the lifestyle part of it, but about the history of the game.
Sport.
Right. And it gives you know, I've seen, especially in New Jersey, we do have a lot of golf clubs and they take that very seriously and they're very proud of. We are a golf club and there's a reason that we don't have the other stuff and we do golf very well. And, you know, since you've been at Winged Foot, you've hosted the Four Ball Championship, the PGA Championship, the U.S. Amateur, and have been two-time host of the U.S. Open.
Yes. Yes.
So talk a little bit about how your role shifts when the circus comes to town, as we like to say.
Well, you know, I think that's part of that's part of, I think, what has kept me so engaged over the last almost 30 years is the fact that when the quote circus does come into town, when the major event does appear on the horizon, that my job shifts completely. I've spent probably 20 of the last 30 years working very hard on the relationship with the USGA, which, and I adore the people I've worked with, Mike Davis, John Bodenhammer, Mike Wan, I don't know particularly well, but I will get to know him. So that changes the day-to-day focus. And the staff in 06 and this past year in 2020, we changed. Now, the hard thing, Allison and Adam, is that we have to maintain a club. So it's not like you stop what you're doing, host the U.S. Open, and then we'll get back to you later. So we're maintaining the membership experience the whole time. Communications, very intensive, because we have, you know, we have a couple of private Instagram accounts. We have a text messaging system that we put in place. Communications is key. So I then have these two sort of big balls up in the air. One is the U.S. Open. One is the membership. And you can't drop either one. So what we do is we get certain members of the staff focused, and it doesn't always appeal to them, but not everybody can have their hands in the U.S. Open or PGA Championship pot. They just can't. So certain people, unfortunately, you say, look, this is, when we get real close, you'll be involved. But in the meantime, we need you to focus on, you know, we're still doing admissions. We're still doing membership things. We're still, you know, we're still sending out bills. We still have, you know, food, beverage activity. We're still maintaining. So all those things have to continue happening. So in my case, I shift a little bit away, have fortunately somebody like Lily, or in 06, I guess it was, I'm trying to think who it was, but it was somebody, I think it was Larry Kaiser at the time. And so they get more responsibility from the sort of membership experience perspective. And I then turn my focus a little bit more on whatever the event is. In this case, I mean, just to dive right into 2020 and what we experienced with moving a U.S. Open from June to September. Well, that sounds, you know, I guess from an outside perspective, you go, well, what's the big deal? You shifted it by a couple of months. Well, it's much more than that. We started working on 2020 in 2013, right? That's when we made the announcement. That's when we signed the letter of intent. I had dinner with Mike Davis and Mike Butts and a few others. And that's sort of, that began the seven-year process. So naturally, we didn't work on it in 13, 14. But when, you know, you get to 15, 16, you're working on it pretty intensely. You're working on the site plan. You're booking hotels. You're going to visit a parking space, 25,000 paved parking spaces you need. I mean, there's hundreds of hotel rooms. You need so many little things. You have to work with the MTA to make sure the trains are running on time. You got to make sure the buses are running on time. You have to work with the governor's office. You go down the list. I mean, it's just, it's you know, the security element alone is tremendous. What the state police do with SWAT teams, response teams. So you have all this stuff lined up, and you get to, you know, you get to, so it's now, you know, December of 19, it's now January of 20, and you're starting to see this thing, or our lives, much more importantly. And that's, by the way, that was the perspective we kept the entire time was, look, as important as the Open is, what's more important is the health and safety of our members, our employees, and players. So we never lost sight of you know, really what was at stake here. I mean, we were 4 miles away from New Rochelle, which was the epicenter in New York. So our perspective was, you know, was pretty real in terms of, you know, what was happening. You heard the ambulances going nonstop. So in any event, so rather than just, well, we moved it from June to September. No, we had to unravel. We were literally about to begin construction on 60 corporate hospitality tents, building roads, doing all this. And we had, I guess it was, you know, the first week in March, and we said, we can't begin construction. We all had the same sense that we're going to build this ghost city, and we're going to destroy turf, and we're going to waste a lot of time and money. So it was that first week of March where we said, no building. If we have to catch up because things, you know, turn positive again, we can do that. But we cannot afford to. So we call, and plus we didn't want people coming onto the property, all the contractors. So that was the beginning of this unraveling. And then just imagine having to put together a COVID plan that had to satisfy the PGA Tour, because they were sort of the lead group in this, right, representing the players. Then having it approved by the governor's office, putting together decks, trying to explain how you're going to create a bubble. So all of these things that were thrown at us in March were not part of this planning process that took place between 2015 and 2019. So back to, I guess, your earlier point or question. So what was my role? My role became consumed with the U.S. Open, with these logistics, with dealing with again, Governor Cuomo's office, and he was very gracious and very supportive. Dr. Zucker, who was his medical expert, our own medical experts, setting up COVID testing for 2,000 people, ensuring that those 2,000 people didn't go out at night and that they comport, you know, they confine themselves so that we can sustain the bubble. So
did you even care?
So a year,
Colin?
You know,
did you even care? Did you even care who won? during all of that? There was the golf scene is like the third or 18th thing you're thinking about.
He was like, golf is played? What?
Yeah, exactly. When I mean, we watched, it's funny, Lily, Tanya, I think we watched maybe two holes because we were so consumed with logistics. And it's funny, you know, naturally, the phone calls started coming in Saturday. Can you get me on? Can you get me on? Can you get me on? And, you know, in a typical U.S. Open, you'd have extra tickets. You'd be able to meet somebody at the gate. There was no one permitted on the property. To answer your question, the only person I wanted to win was Phil. And because we'd gotten very close in 06. And as a matter of fact, just as an aside, he actually called me about 2 weeks after the Open. And I was in a staff meeting. I didn't recognize the number. I said, oh, who the hell is this? And I didn't answer it. Well, it's funny. One of my brothers said, good thing you didn't answer because now you have it in voicemail. the message from Phil. So I didn't think about it at the time. I was like, oh my God, that was Phil. I can't believe I didn't take his call. But now I've been able to play it for people ad nauseum. And talk about gracious and charming and just, you know, he was so happy to be here. And obviously things didn't work out in 06. That was you know, tremendously tragic for him and his following. So no, I really didn't care who was going to win.
I've got an interesting anecdote. I guess I'll let you be the judge if it's interesting or not. But I played Oakmont one time, and well, once and only once. I played Oakmont, shot a 101, by the way, for those of you keeping score at home, because it's incredibly difficult. And I had some problems with the rough and the bunkers, but other than that, everything else was fine. My game, the green sucked. Everything else was fine. So I played Oakmont, and I'm sitting on the in the locker room there, and this is an old locker room, and there's these benches there. And what the attendant said, hey, so you know where you're sitting, Sam Snead put his metal spikes right there. Those are his marks. Now, is that true or not? I have no idea. It might have been Gary from the weekend. I don't know.
But you tell that story all the time, don't you?
I was sucked into that story, and I've told it, and I've thought about that moment. Like, if that is true, how cool is that? What's that story at Wingfoot that is that kind of that lore of your place?
Well, Adam and Allison, if you were to show up at the front door right now, I would give you what Lily referred to somewhat sort of sarcastically after a while as the nickel tour. And so I begin the process by telling you about the building in Charles Wendehack and how, you know, Tillinghast and Wendehack, this combination was just was magical. How not only were the golf courses, you know, built to perfection, but the clubhouse. I would tell you about the Hope's windows that are still the original. I tell you about the slate roof. I would tell you about how we found the metal worker, the company that actually did the original doorknobs and doorstops and the escutcheons. And they're on Jane Street, a company called P.E. Guerin. We tracked them down. And the guy, he's a member out at Arcola in New Jersey. And he said, you know what? He said, I think my father actually did the work at the club. He went into one of these design books because they weren't using photography then, and these sketchbooks. And he said, yeah, this is all the work we did at Wingfoot. So I would give you all of that. And then we'd look at a couple of the big, beautiful photographs that we pulled out of archives, and I'd show you the one that shows pre-Wingfoot what the driveway looked like back in 1923, I guess it was, and the silver maple LA, which my youngest son likes to tease me about that. That's just alley in French, but I say I like the way LA sounds. I use it like quinoa. There are certain things I try to work into every conversation. Bougie. Yeah, it's part of, you know, part of being a cool dad, you know. And so so then I'd probably look at the other picture and show you this great, dark, gloomy picture of Charles Nobles teeing it up on 10 West. And none of the homes are there, but the tree that's now behind the home on behind 10 West is there. And there's a little boy at a tee box. He's at a tee box. He's not standing on the tee box. He's standing in the teeing ground. What was the tee box? Well, before the dentist from New Jersey who created the what was it called, the ready tee, which was a wooden tee that they used to attach a string to. And I would give you all of this, by the way, if you wanted to pay the dime for the dime tour, I'd go into even greater detail. And that was the tee box, was where the little bit of sand and clay was that they would pinch and put in the teeing ground for you to tee it up.
That's
so
a good story.
Then we would, now we haven't even gotten past the lobby at this point. Now we'd get to the first display case, and we'd show you our display of the six U.S. Opens, which we're having it having all the cases curated once again, because we need to make room for 2020 and then hopefully a future U.S. Open. And so so as you walk in, you're going to be struck with not just the beauty of the facilities, the fact that we have gone through such great effort to maintain the windows, to maintain all the hardware, to maintain, we created, and Allison, you saw it, we had photos from 1926, the striations in the rug, the design of the rug all came from that. The hex table in the lobby is a recreation of what was there. And we have photos that you can juxtapose all of this too. And so you get to, you're then struck by, you know, the five U.S. Opens, now six, PGA Championship, Walker Cup. And now you're in this sort of the Hall of Fame, if you will. And you will look down and you will not see Sam Snead's spike marks, but you will see a run of tile that I knew was there, having been here this long, but we had covered up with carpet all these years. And they're beautiful, heavy gauge tiles. And on the back of them, they all say Handmade Wales and Heather Brown. And those were shipped here. Think about this. This is 1923. They shipped those tiles from Holland to here because they wanted the best of everything. I mean, it's just crazy.
It's amazing.
So now, again, you know, I'm breathless, you're tired, and we haven't even gotten past the first case.
And this is only a dime?
This is we're going towards a quarter now. And then you'd see all the great players. You would see, I mean, dating back to old Tom Morris, who donated a club that he used winning an Open that he dedicated to the club. And then you see the honorary members, the portraiture that Paul Dillon, you know, Matt and Kevin Dillon's dad, the actors, yeah. Kevin and Matt. Mm-hmm. Well, Kev's a member. He's great. Cal, what's going on? He's just, you know, he's crazy. I see him buying jeans at Roberts, the Army Navy store, and the rest of the boys. Matt's not a member, but we see him all the time. Their father is a great portrait artist. He was the coach of the Fordham golf team for I don't know how many decades. And so you'd then be struck. You'd see Mr. Palmer. You'd see Billy Casper, Claude Harmon, our beloved Tom Neoporti, who was the pro here for many, many years. And so at every turn, you're seeing golf greatness, golf events, all of it in this beautiful, this historic building. So it's hard not to, you know, sort of get where you are the minute you walk in.
Phenomenal. The history part always just gets me right in the feels, you know.
Yeah,
I love that.
Yeah, it's
stuff.
Good. And then you know, it's you know, Allison, it's the lamps, the chandeliers in the grill room, the oak paneling, all of it. I mean, we've made such an effort to keep it restored, not to replace. Matter of fact, we're going through the process now. We're having new grill room chairs made. We found a father and son. Off the boat, Italian, lovely, beautiful guys. They're making them in Brooklyn. It's taken 2 years. When you see these chairs, I mean, they are pieces of artwork. Every one of them is literally being handmade from black walnut. Now, it's taken a little bit longer than we wanted, but it's a natural process. The point of that is we could have just gone and said, let's buy some chairs. Stick in the grill room. Instead, we said
it seems easier that way.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it would have been. I would have gone harassed a lot less because, by the way, we're now literally going on 2 years. It'll be June. Thank God we had chairs available in the meantime. But we could have done that. But we said, no, we want, just like we sought out P.E. Guerin, we sought out Hopes. And it's not Hope, it's Hopes, the window company, when we needed repairs done. So we've gone through great lengths. And by the way, I mean, how can I not mention the work that's been done on the golf courses, the Gilhance restoration of both golf courses? I mean, the effort that went into capturing or recapturing the original shapes of the greens, these beautiful sort of rounded rectangles with these big shoulders and all of those features that were that existed back in the 20s, but that were lost. So in some respects, the club, I think, and this is just my two cents, looks better now than it has, except for maybe when it first opened. And I say that very humbly. We've been on a very aggressive capital campaign. We've touched almost every inch of the property. And I'll never forget when, so Brad Steinthal, who's just one of our dearest members, he's our most senior member, we did the renovation of the clubhouse, so it was 3 years ago now. He walked in, and you're always curious as to how members will react, particularly older members. He walked in, he looked around, and he said, "This is how it looked when I was a kid."
Oh,
and I looked at Lily, I said, "We did it. That was pretty cool. This is how it looked when I was a kid."
Well, it doesn't
Which was
get
like
much better
the
than
ultimate
that.
Compliment because he remembers, you know, back in the, when it was, I guess it was the 30s. So that's the story you get for a quarter.
It's a good story. It's a damn good story. Well, Winged Foot is a very special place and you are a special leader in the industry. So we really appreciate you coming
you,
and
Allison.
Sharing your time with us and giving us the lowdown and some history. And we just really appreciate it.
Next time I'll tell you some great golf stories about Sylvester Stallone or Prince Moulay Rashid and other people who we met over the years, Michael Jordan. I mean, that'll be another
not
episode.
Not interested, Colin, we'll but thanks it. Anyway.
So, Adam, that was such a fun conversation. One of the things that really stood out to me from a business perspective is, you know, I've hired on all sides of the coin in golf, and typically when I get cover letters and it says, "I love the game of golf," I'm like, don't care. Because when I'm running a tournament, like Colin mentioned, you know, they only saw two holes the whole week and there were no spectators there. When I'm working on a tournament, I am so busy. I don't care if you like golf, like you better be working. So I thought it was really interesting to hear Colin's take on hiring and having a passion for the game of golf be something that he's really interested in and looking for.
Yeah. For me, the best part of that entire interview and conversation, you put a dime in him apparently and just let him go because he has a story, and with his career there, he probably just touched the surface, but his passion for his place, that's his place. That's his place of work. That's his house. That's his home. That's his family. That's everything that he is and embodies is at Winged Foot. To hear him talk about it, I hope that I get a chance to go there and experience that firsthand, because it as a lover of golf or a lover of history, a lover of the history of golf, of beautiful architecture, of old architecture, of the old and the new and the old. My God, I mean, I could listen to him talk for forever. So very, very cool. Great, great guest.
Awesome. Well, every time I walk onto a golf course, I have this sense of gratitude that this is the industry we get to work in, right? So it is a special, special thing. So that was a very fun interview. Thanks all for listening. This is The Business of Golf, hosted on the Stick and Hack Network.